Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is September the 30th, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. A major hospital system had been hit with cyber attack, potentially largest in U.S. history. A major hospital chain has been hit by what appears to be one of the largest medical cyber attacks in United States history. Computer Systems for Universal Health Services, which has more than 400 locations, primarily in the United States, began to fail over the weekend, according to multiple people familiar with the situation. Over the weekend, hospitals in the United States operated by Universal Health Services started to notice problems with their IT systems, with some employees reporting that they could not access their computers. Universal Health Services did not immediately respond to requests for comment, but posted a statement to its website that its company-wide network is currently offline due to an IT security issue. One person familiar with the company's response efforts, who was not authorized to speak to the press, said that the attack looks and smells like ransomware. The company says it doesn't appear like employee or patient data was accessed in the incident. UHS cares for approximately 3.5 million patients each year and operates about 400 healthcare facilities across the United States and United Kingdom. In a statement the company issued this Monday morning, UHS said its computer network is down due to an IT security issue. We implement extensive IT security protocols and are working diligently with our IT patient care, are working diligently with our IT security partners to restore IT operations as quickly as possible. Patient care continues to be delivered safely and effectively. From what has been published, they have not succumbed to ransomware demands as it appears that they are recovering using backup data. Ransomware is a type of malicious software that spreads across computer networks, encrypting files and demanding payment for a key to decrypt them. It's become a common tactic for hackers, though attacks of this scale against medical facilities aren't common. A patient died after a ransomware attack against a German hospital in early September, which required her to be moved to a different hospital, leading to speculation that it may be the first known death from ransomware. NBC News reports some UHS hospitals have had to fall back on filing patient information using pen and paper due to the attack. On Reddit and Twitter, there are also reports of UHS facilities redirecting ambulances to other nearby hospitals. When the attack happened, multiple antivirus programs were disabled by the attack. A UHS employee said they saw files renamed during the attack to include a .ryk extension. That extension is associated with the Ryuk ransomware, and like most other ransomware, Ryuk encrypts files to prevent someone from accessing them until they pay a fee. If UHS was the victim of a ransomware attack, it wouldn't be the first time a healthcare provider had been the target of a cyber attack. On September the 9th, Dusseldorf University Hospital in Germany sent a patient to a hospital 19 miles away after hackers compromised their IT systems in a ransomware attack. The patient died while doctors tried to transfer her to the other hospital. Passing laws to prevent this from happening again in the future may be futile, but why not pass a law that the penalty for a ransomware attack is life imprisonment with no chance for probation? And if the ransomware resulted in a death, the life sentence will be served in solitary confinement. Ransomware attacks is only a harbinger of what may happen as the Internet of Things are being rolled out. We lack any comprehensive standards and control to ensure user privacy and security with the Internet of Things. Most Americans think big tech is spying on them. An overwhelming 85% of respondents indicated they believe at least one tech company is spying on them. It's widely understood that most of our internet behavior, from the sites we visit to the types of videos we watch, is constantly being tracked. But are companies going beyond this and actually spying on us to collect their data? Whistleout was interested to know if Americans think big tech is spying on them, and if so, which companies they believe are the biggest perpetrators. An overwhelming 85% of the respondents indicated they believe at least one tech company is spying on them. Facebook is suspected of spying the most. 68% of those surveyed believe the social media giant is violating their privacy. Meanwhile, 53% suspect TikTok is spying on them. It's possible that high-profile news about both companies could influence the public belief of whether or not they are spying. Facebook has been heavily criticized about privacy concerns, while TikTok has faced a full ban in the United States over concerns with the Chinese government having access to large amounts of data on American citizens. Of those who believe that big tech companies are snooping, 80% believe that these companies are listening to their phone conversations. Again, participants in the study suspect Facebook and TikTok are the major culprits. Almost two-thirds of the participants, that's 65%, claimed they had an ad for a specific product they've talked about but never searched for online. While the majority of respondents think big tech companies are spying, 57% weren't sure what the companies are doing with the information they are acquiring. Although it's widely understood that companies collect data for advertising and marketing purposes, only 24% of participants believe that these companies spy in order to tailor their ads and content to users. That's a surprisingly low percentage, considering that almost two-thirds of the people in their study, that's about 65%, claim that they have seen or heard an advertisement for a specific product on a big tech company's app or website after talking about that product but not searching for that product online. Whistleout was curious to find out how people were reacting to this perceived threat to privacy and how they feel the government should intervene. They found that when Americans have privacy concerns about an app, many would simply delete or stop using it. 40% of TikTok users in their survey said they'd deleted or stopped using the app before due to privacy concerns. Similarly, about 18% of Facebook users in their survey said they deleted or stopped using the app before due to privacy concerns. As for government intervention, more than half of the participants in their survey, that's 57%, feel the United States government should step in and ban at least one major tech company for violating user privacy. Of the major tech companies, that's those that were in the survey making multiple selections, 37% of participants believe TikTok should be banned. 20% of the participants believe Facebook should be banned. 13% of the participants believe Instagram should be banned. Despite Apple's outward concern for its users' data and privacy, more than 30% of the participants believe that the tech giant is spying on them. Apple plan on implementing a slew of privacy protection policies and features in their latest operating system, iOS 14. Among these new protections are alerts to let users know when an app is using their phone's mic and/or camera, and privacy reports that let users track who is tracking them. Most controversially is a feature that requires apps and websites to give users a clear choice to opt in or out of being tracked. Due to some opposition, Apple has delayed full implementation of these measures to allow more time for developers to comply, though it is expected to be launched in early 2021. That'll give ample time to developers to develop a workaround. Whistle Out surveyed 1,000 people about their beliefs relating to major tech companies and spying practices. Participants were located in all 50 states, with ages ranging from 16 to 54, and the survey was distributed online via PoFish. Google Meet is a teleconference app similar to Zoom, and the company temporarily gave all users free meetings with no time limit early this year. Google said in April it would allow unlimited length meetings in its Google Meet video chat platform for all users until September the 30th, and it looks like the company is sticking with that timeline. Today is September the 30th. Free versions of Meet will be limited to meetings no longer than 60 minutes. And a Google spokesperson said they don't have anything to communicate regarding changes to the promo and advanced features expiring. Additionally, the spokesperson said that if this changes, we'll be sure that they'll let us know. Under the extension, anyone with a Google account could create free meetings with up to 100 people and with no time limit. Also going away September 30th are access to advanced features for G Suite and G Suite for Education customers, including allowing meetings of up to 250 participants, live streams of up to 100,000 people within a single domain, and the ability to save meeting recordings to Google Drive. Those features are normally only available to customers on the enterprise tier of G Suite, which costs $25 per user per month. Google Meet and other video conferencing platforms have been chasing the meteoric rise of Zoom during the coronavirus pandemic, with Meet passing 100 million daily participants back in April. Of course, what this deadline means for most users who don't want to upgrade to a paid Meet plan is to have to limit their conference calls to 60 minutes, and for most, this is not going to be a problem at all. What is Windows Insider Program? The Windows Insider Program is a community of millions of Windows' biggest fans who get to be the first to see what's next. Windows Insiders run previews of the platform called Windows 10 Insider Preview. Then they give feedback to Microsoft and engage directly with the engineers to help shape the future of Windows. How do you become an insider for Windows 10? It's pretty easy. You go to Settings, Update and Security, Windows Insider Program on your Windows 10 device, and follow the instructions. Well, where am I going with all this? Microsoft released Windows 10 Build 20221 to the development channel with Meet Now. Meet Now in Skype allows you to easily set up a collaboration space and invite both Skype contacts and friends or family who are not on Skype. Participants can then easily join meetings whether they have an account or not. Last Wednesday, Microsoft introduced Meet Now in the Windows 10 taskbar. Earlier this year, Microsoft introduced Meet Now in Skype, which is a teleconferencing function in Skype. Meet Now makes it easy to connect with anyone in as little as 2 clicks for free, and each call can last up to 24 hours. Microsoft is extending this capability in Windows 10 by bringing Meet Now right to the taskbar. You can now easily set up a video call and reach friends and family in an instant by clicking on the Meet Now icon in the notification area system tray of the taskbar in Windows 10. No signups or downloads are needed. This feature is rolling out to a subset of insiders in the development channel, first to help Microsoft quickly identify issues that may impact performance and reliability. Rest assured they will be gradually rolled out to everyone in the development channel. This build is from Windows 10 development branch, as are most builds in the development channel, and that means it's not tied to a specific feature update. Once something is promoted to the beta channel, then which feature will arrive in which update? Meet Now allows Windows 10 users to connect with anyone and easily set up a collaboration space in just 2 clicks. It's free, and no sign up or download is required. Participants can then easily join meetings, whether they have a Skype account or not, and from any device, mobile, desktop, or laptop. All you need to do is start a video call, is click the Meet Now icon in the system tray, and click or tap Create a Meeting. Meet Now will open a browser window to launch the meeting experience. You can edit the meeting name and share the meeting link with others. Once you're ready to turn your microphone and or camera on as preferred, and click and or tap the Start Meeting button. Once you start the meeting, you'll be greeted with the usual Skype meeting experience. There's the ability to chat, react, of course with emojis, and share your screen. Each call can last up to 24 hours, although the meeting doesn't expire at all. This feature will be in the Windows 10 October 2020 update. For most people, the rollout will probably begin by year end. If you want to know what else is coming down the pike with Windows 10 features, you can join the Windows Insider program. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. Work is 25x8.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now this is where we get down to business. We talk about the world of the IT professional. I'm going to take you back in time, and I'm going to remind you of how the Flintstones cartoon opened up. It was always a matter of Fred Flintstone working on that big, huge brontosaurus, and he was sitting there, and all of a sudden he would hear the whistle blow. That was the signal of the end of the day. And he would hop off of the top of the brontosaurus, and he'd slide on down, and he'd go, yabba-dabba-doo, and he was really happy. He was not an IT. He was not an IT professional. He was, I mean, most of us, you know, we are prepared. Most people are prepared to put in a little bit of overtime if the boss asks us. In the IT world, it's not always the boss that asks us. In the IT professional's entire kingdom, it's sometimes the inanimate, the computer itself that screams out, says, "Hey, Ben!" In my case, Ben, I might say Fred to, you know, Mr. Flintstone. But, you know, it's going to scream out and it's going to say, "I have a problem. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm not going to tell you how long you're going to be here. All I know is it ain't working, so you got to fix me." And this isn't like a car. This isn't like most of the things around the world, save, you know, once in a while. You've got plumbing, you've got electrical, you've got some of the bare basics of society. You know, the electric company, if a transformer goes out, the folks are going to work overtime. They've got an idea of how long it's going to take. The plumber has an idea of how long it will be before he fixes up this one leaky pipe. He knows where the pipe is. He knows how to fix it. But even in the IT world, sometimes we deal with a problem and we're uncovering more problems beyond that. And it's sometimes what we call a cascade failure. It's like that set of dominoes that you set up and you push the first one over and they all go and they all knock over. I recall one day I put in my full shift. I normally left. I would arrive at 7 a.m. and I would leave about 3:30. Sometimes a little bit after, if something was, you know, I was in the middle of a project or something was occurring. And that, you know, and that happens. But what happened was at about 3:15, I'm packing up everything and somebody said, "Hey, I opened up an email I don't think I should have." And I clicked on the link inside and I don't think I should have clicked on the link. And I panicked and I said, "Turn off your computer." Unfortunately, it was a little bit late. His computer had already gone through. It had been infected and it started to encrypt the files on his local drive, as well as some of the files on our network. So I then just hunkered down and I proceeded to work through the night. Now, mind you, I'd already been, there for 8 hours. And I continued on through the night. And I continued on through till the wee hours of the morning and into the next business day. And then sometime around 5 o'clock the following day, I had finally recovered all of the files. I had wiped his desktop clean. I actually found out two people got to that email. The other one didn't say anything and was totally oblivious. And I had wiped and recovered that laptop. And I had gone through and I scanned all of the computers within the company to make sure that they were all safe. And that's one of the things you have to be prepared to do. You have to be prepared to live off of caffeine and candy and whatever is deliverable at midnight, which sometimes might be Chinese food, might be pizza, and it might be nothing if you lose track of time. That was one of the things that as an IT professional, I learned early on, years ago, that I should always have a meal set aside. I should always have some food on hand just in case everything went crazy. And it often did. You can't predict everything. You cannot be prepared to handle everything if you're not prepared to provide yourself caffeine, provide yourself, food, sustenance. And that's unfortunate. In the smaller environments, I was an IT professional and I was basically the entire IT staff as well. And it works out differently in different companies. There's a lot more IT staff, but sometimes it might be a matter of you have a specialty that nobody else has. You might have some knowledge that nobody else can conquer. Most IT professionals have some level of experience that the other members on the team do not have. If we were all, equally adept at, I'll pick Linux or Windows or whatever it is, if we were all perfectly fine at it, it wouldn't matter. But just like doctors, there's always something that we know that some of the other doctors don't know, or in this case, IT professionals. Think about that a little bit. If you are struggling with your IT guy, he's got this, glazed over look. Maybe he's been putting in way too many hours lately. Maybe he needs a little bit of sympathy rather than you just screaming at him, calling him a nerd. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Many of us are familiar with a computer bit. A bit, which is short for binary digit, is the smallest unit of measurement used to quantify computer data. It contains a single binary value of 0 or 1. The computers that we're familiar with use bits as their basic unit of data. Each bit can be either true or false, on or off, or 0 or 1. Now there are computers with qubit, that's Q-U-B-I-T. Well, what the heck is a qubit? Quantum computers use qubits. Like bits, qubits can be either one of two states when measured, but that's where the similarities end. Qubits use quantum mechanic phenomena like superposition and entanglement to exist in multiple states at the same time until measured and to hold up to 2 bits worth of data. That's a mouthful. It's like saying, is the cup of glass half empty? Or is it half full? In other words, it's not full, it's not empty, it's half empty or half full. Qubits, on the other hand, can hold a 0, a 1, or any portion of both 0 and 1 at the same time. An array of qubits can use superposition to represent all 2 to the power of 64 possible values at once, allowing a quantum computer to solve problems that are practically impossible for standard computers. There are today a number of quantum computers in the labs. And what's the timeline for them to be practical?
reliable, and cost-effective to be used in mainstream computing. Well, IBM released a plan to have 1,000-qubit quantum computer by 2023. That's pretty near term. The point at which quantum computers transition from expensive science experiments to a technology that could reshape the future may seem far away, but a new technology roadmap from IBM suggests that timeline might be much closer. Despite hundreds of millions of dollars pouring into the field, today's quantum computers are still pretty rudimentary. IBM's largest quantum processors today are 65 qubits, a shade behind the biggest competitor, Google, which has 72-qubit device. That's a long way from millions of qubits likely to be needed to do practical computations. IBM plans to launch a 127-qubit processor next year, with a 433-qubit processor in 2022. And by 2023, they expect to hit the 1,121 qubits with a processor codenamed Condor, which they think will be the inflection point for the commercialization of quantum technology. One of the biggest problems facing quantum technology is their susceptibility to disturbances, which can easily introduce errors into their calculations. IBM hopes to bring error rates down from 1% today to 1/1000th of 1% in the Condor processor. IBM has intimated that it's targeting a 1,000,000-qubit device by 2030, which incidentally is the same timeline as with Google. It will require breakthroughs in everything from material science to cryogenics and software to run these devices. IBM released their roadmap to give other players in the quantum computing industry the confidence to specialize in specific areas rather than everyone trying to do everything. It's not clear whether IBM will really be the pace setter in this race. While Google has been fairly quiet this year, it still has today's hotly disputed bragging rights as the first company to achieve quantum supremacy, carrying out a computation that would be impossibly difficult for a normal computer. However, industrial conglomerate Honeywell also burst out of left field earlier this year with what it claims is the world's most powerful quantum computer. The Honeywell device claims that it outperforms all other devices announced so far in a performance measure invented by IBM called quantum volume. Honeywell says it expects to be able to increase the quantum volume of its system tenfold every year, which would leave rivals in the dust if it comes to fruition. Several other rivals have made bets on different quantum technologies. Intel is pursuing silicon qubits built using the same raw materials and processors as today's computer chips, which are less advanced than alternative, but to hold the promise of massive scalability. And Microsoft has made a Hail Mary for topological quantum computing. Well, let's get back to basics. How can a qubit be 1 and 0 at the same time? And in human terms, that sounds like a maybe. Quantum computing relies on quantum bits or qubits, which can also represent a 0 or 1. The crazy thing is, qubits can also achieve a mixed state called a superposition, where they are both 1 and 0 at the same time. This ambiguity, the ability to be both be and not be, is the key to the power of quantum computing. Entanglement is a physical relationship between two or more qubits in which one qubit seems to know what happens to another even when they are a large distance apart. Entangled qubits becomes a system with a single quantum state. If you measure one qubit, that is to say, collapse its superposition to a single state, you will have the same impact on the other qubits in the system. Thanks to entanglement, qubits can hold up to 2 bits of data and transmit data between qubits up to 1,400 meters apart. Qubits can be used to execute quantum algorithms. Mathematicians have developed advanced algorithms that can only be run using quantum computers full of qubits. Algorithms such as Shor's algorithm for integer factorization, given an integer, find its prime factors, and Grover's algorithm for searching an unstructured database. These algorithms will be able to solve certain problems much faster than the algorithms our current computers can execute. problems like breaking public key encryption schemes. What is then quantum computing and how does it work? Quantum computers perform calculations based on the probability of an object state before it is measured instead of just one or zero, which means they have the potential to process exponentially more data compared to classical computers. Why is quantum computing important? Quantum computing is said to be more powerful, efficient than modern computing through the use of quantum tunneling. They are expected to reduce power consumption from 100 to 1,000 times. Quantum computers can speed up the learning process of artificial intelligence, reducing thousands of years of learning to mere seconds. Who invented quantum computing? In 1998, Isaac Chung of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Neil Gershenfeld of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Mark Kubinek of the University of California at Berkeley created the first quantum computer, which was 2 qubits, that could be loaded with data and output a solution. How fast is a qubit? A 30-qubit quantum computer would equal the processing power of a conventional computer that could run at 10 teraflops, that's trillions of floating point operations per second. That's mind-boggling. Today's typical desktop computers run at speed measured in gigaflops. That's billions of floating point operations per second. Where is quantum computing used? The intent of quantum computers is to be a different tool to solve different problems, not to replace our traditional classical computers. Quantum computers are great for solving optimization problems, from figuring out the best way to schedule flights at an airport to determine the best delivery routes for the FedEx truck. A powerful quantum computer could crack the cryptographic algorithms that keep our data safe. Who owns a quantum computer today? IBM releases the IBM Q Experience, a public online interface to its quantum processors. IBM builds a working 17-qubit computer, IBM builds a working 50-qubit computer, and Intel announced Tango Lake, a 49-qubit superconducting chip. Quantum computing could change the world, and it could transform medicine, break encryption, and revolutionize communications and artificial intelligence. Companies like IBM, Microsoft, and Google are racing to build reliable quantum computers. By the way, China's in the mix and they've already invested billions into this. The world's most powerful supercomputer today is Summit, built by IBM for the U.S. Department of Energy's Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. It occupies the equivalent of 2 basketball courts and achieves an impressive 148.6 petaflops thanks to 2.41 million cores. Can you build a quantum computer at home? At least, I like to think so. And even though IBM's own quantum computing hardware consists of superconducting qubits, Qiskit, that's Q-I-S-K-I-T, is meant to be hardware agnostic. You really could and can build a quantum system using commercially available parts, and you can even control and program your device using open source software like Qiskit, Q-I-S-K-I-T. But in a quantum computer, each qubit influences the other qubits around it, working together to arrive at a solution. Superposition and entanglement are what gives quantum computers the ability to process so much more information so much faster. So today, who has the fastest quantum computer? It's Honeywell. Honeywell, as of today, is the quantum computing champ. Honeywell said it boosted its performance of its quantum computer enough to beat that of IBM's by one closely watched measure. The achievement gives Honeywell machine the title of world's fastest quantum computer, at least for the time being. How do quantum computers work? Quantum computing performs calculations based on the probability of an object state before it is measured. Instead of just ones and zero, which means they have the potential to process exponentially more data compared to classical computers, and classical computers carry out logical operations using the definite position of a physical state. These are usually binary, meaning its operations are based on one of two positions. A single state, such as on, off, up or down, one or zero, is called a bit. In quantum computing, operations instead use the quantum state of an object to produce what's known as qubit. These states are the undefined properties of an object before they've been detected, such as the spin of an electron or the polarization of a photon. Rather than having a clear position, unmeasured quantum states occur in a mixed superposition, not unlike a coin spinning through the air before it lands in your hand. These superpositions can be entangled with those of other objects, meaning their final outcomes will be mathematically related, even if we don't know yet what they are. The complex mathematics behind these unsettled states of entangled spinning coins can be plugged into special algorithms to make short work of problems that would take a classical computer a long time to work out, if they could ever calculate them at all. Such algorithms would be useful in solving complex mathematical problems, producing hard-to-break security codes, or predicting multiple particle interactions and chemical reactions. There are different types of quantum computings. Building a functional quantum computer requires holding an object in a superposition state long enough to carry out various processes on them. Unfortunately, once a superposition meets with materials that are part of a measured system, it loses its in-between state in what is known as decoherence and becomes a boring old classical bit. Devices need to be able to shield quantum states from decoherence while still making them easy to read. Different processes are tackling this challenge from different angles, whether it's to use more robust quantum processes or to find better ways to check for errors. For the time being, classical technology can manage any task thrown at a quantum computer. Quantum supremacy describes the ability of a quantum computer to outperform the classical counterparts. Some companies such as IBM and Google claim that they're close and they continue to cram more qubits together and build more accurate devices. Not everybody's convinced that quantum computers are worth the effort. Some mathematicians believe there are obstacles that are practically impossible to overcome, putting quantum computing forever out of reach. Time will tell who's right. There are 10 countries actively working on quantum computing technology. As tech giants like Google are advancing for gaining quantum supremacy, quantum technologies are becoming more and more glorious in different parts of the world. Several countries are running in the race of leading the world with the technology of quantum computing. Notably, according to market reports, the following are the top 10 leading companies in the race for quantum computing technology. In the lead, of course, is the United States, followed by Canada, Germany, France, UK, the Netherlands, Russia, China, South Korea, and of course, Japan. Who's going to get there first? Time will tell. Stay tuned. Received email from listener JB from the Bronx. He commented that Craigslist hasn't updated their website in over 10 years and feel it is user unfriendly. Do I have any comments on it? Well, Craigslist is an American classified advertisement website with sections devoted to jobs, housing, personals, for sale, items wanted, services, community, gigs, and the list goes on and on. Early this year, in February, they celebrated the 25th anniversary of operation. I remember having Jim Buckmaster, who is Craigslist CEO, as a guest of the show about 20 years ago. Craigslist is a bit of an anomaly on the internet, as their website has an old-school look. Craigslist has grown to the behemoth of today with billions of page views a month and has an estimated revenue of more than $1 billion annually. The site was founded by Craig Newmark, who started it as an email list of friends about happenings in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1995. Jim Buckmaster, Craig's CEO, has been in his job for 2 decades. They're both just old-school engineer-type guys who just really believes in keeping design as simple and functional as possible. It has a loyal following, so it's just never been forced to adapt to any other different format. Craigslist doesn't run banner ads. It doesn't sell user data, to third parties. It makes money by charging a small number of users to post ads, ads like job postings, real estate ads, and if you're like a car dealer, furniture dealer, you have to pay a small amount of money. We're talking like $5 to $25, and that makes up this entire revenue stream. For most people, it's totally free. It's become the biggest market for classified ads on the internet. On Craigslist, users posting anonymously. That policy goes back to Craigslist's early days to the 1990s, when it was very common to be anonymous online or using pseudonyms. They have never let go of that policy, and they see that policy as providing a form of protection and privacy to their users. Craigslist is part of the poor people's internet. What's meant by that is Craigslist sort of has this stigma that using it means you're lower class, using it means you're sort of hard up, but it also meant that people of color, poor people, found that they could use the site in a way that really made sense to them. On a site like Craigslist, you can rent an apartment, you can try and search for a job, and you don't have to worry about people discriminating against you because you're anonymous. Craigslist is a platform that is sort of outside the mainstream. Craigslist has been online for so long, it hasn't had to change its politics. So Craigslist hold on to these early 1990s web values about a platform being truly accessible. The platform being open and a platform that doesn't change its appearance. And in that sense, Craigslist remind us there's a path that a company can take. Craigslist is currently privately owned, and it doesn't disclose revenue figures. And the 50-person company is owned entirely by its founder, Craig Newmark, and CEO, Jim Buckmaster. Forbes valued the company at $3 billion. Not bad at all. I wouldn't change the look of the website. Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation. Peripheral Rose.
Listen to this list of technology products. In fact, not just technology products. Listen carefully and think about these products. For some of you, these are museum pieces, things you only see on old movies or TV shows. For some of you, you grew up with them. For some of you, there may be one of everything in a closet or a drawer in one of your rooms or the garage. And as you listen to this, see if you can tell me what these things all have in common. Ready? Wristwatch. Pocket calculator. Instant camera. Camcorder. Pocket calendar. Weather station. Cordless phone. Answering machine. Encyclopedia. Pocket dictionary. Portable recorder. Pocket notepad. Portable television, pocket flashlight, roadmap, portable radio, magnifying glass, pocket address book, pocket travel game or puzzle book, pager. That was 20 separate items. Again, but more rapidly, wristwatch, pocket calculator, instant camera, camcorder, pocket calendar, weather station, cordless phone, answering machine, encyclopedia, pocket dictionary, portable recorder, pocket notepad, portable television, pocket flashlight, roadmap, portable radio, magnifying glass, pocket address book, pocket travel game or puzzle book, and pager. Here's what they all have in common. Everything that all of these things used to do are things that your smartphone has taken over doing for you. And often, the smartphone's faster and better. What happened? Well, it's what always tends to happen. What used to be separate products or add-ons or peripherals, if they're truly useful, become added features in newer things that can handle them. It isn't about saving money. You don't pay upwards of $500 for a smartphone to get what might, on a stretch, cost you $500 to buy as separate products. And it isn't so much about not having to carry all of that other stuff. You wouldn't. Truthfully, How often do you use a calculator or even your smartphone's calculator app? Did you even know that your smartphone app has a scientific calculator mode? Do you care? This isn't about explaining or justifying. It's more the tricorder effect, if we can use that old Star Trek prop as a reference. One thing with multiple purposes. And if it's cheap and easy to add one more purpose, no matter how seldom most people would use it, then why not? It comes down to this. Truly useful peripherals or accessories or adjuncts will always tend to find their functionality become a small part of a more complex product. Want to talk about the PC? They came out about 40 years ago. The first peripherals were printers, modems, and storage devices. Some of the first accessories added memory or added storage or improved graphics. Today's lowest price computers almost all have some built-in way to connect to the internet. They almost all have enough memory and storage that you can get basic work done without any need to enhance those. Wi-Fi and USB and Bluetooth are built into them, so external things like drives or mics or speakers or added displays or cameras are off-the-shelf plug-and-chug purchases. That's not news. That stuff everybody knows. No, they hadn't figured it all out 40 years ago, and they still haven't figured out how to deal with spam and robocalls and deliberate third-party corruption of social media for selfish purposes. At the same time, it isn't just about PCs and smartphones. What's in your dashboard? We didn't always have cars telling us when the tires are low. Flashing hazard lights are only about 50 years old as a standard accessory. AM radios were popular, but not standard. Car audio went through a lot of transitions. FM and stereo and satellite radio, 4-track tape players, 8-track players, cassette players, CD players, reverb systems, amplified rear deck speakers, electrically retracting and extending antennas. Some things are still just as likely to be owner added or shop installed later as they are to be standard equipment. Backup warnings, backup cameras, lane drift monitors, navigation, speakerphone functionality, radar detectors, dash cams, overspeed alerts. It's a long list, but we'll stop there. You know where else you see that trend of taking what used to be separate stuff and sucking it up into some bigger system? Home automation. Only that's still a battleground. The personal assistants want a chunk of it, so do the thermostat makers and the alarm system people, and so on and more and so on and more. It's crazy. Let's go back to the calculator in your smartphone. Some people will argue that it's a crutch, that you need to know how to do math in your head or longhand. Some will even claim that you need to prepare even more, with experience on an abacus and a slide rule. Phooey. Do you have any idea how many centuries people got along fine with their number systems before those systems adapted to zero being a number? There's nothing essentially right or wrong about being an old way or a new way. Back in school. Back in school, one of the best math teachers was always reminding us that any approach, any technique that consistently delivers valid results is a valid technique. Not that you weren't still expected to show your work. Oh, brother. By the way, what you've just heard about truly useful products that start as peripherals, eventually coming into a mainstream realm, well, that's often also true of people. There are always pioneers. Before psychology and psychiatry could become a productive part of personal care, there had to be a Sigmund Freud. One might even argue that fictional examples also hold sway, like the role Sherlock Holmes played in popularizing a forensics approach to evidentiary crime solving. Would you like a peek at the future? It starts now. It starts by recognizing what's clunky and figuring out less clunky ways to get it done. What's in your basement? A furnace? A hot water heater? A water softener with a brine tank? Shift your perspective. Your HVAC starts with ductwork and a fan. What peripherals are attached to that? A furnace? An air conditioner? A thermostat? Good start. How about a humidifier? A dehumidifier? a forced fresh air intake, a way to disinfect pathogens in the air, a way to only use energy to maintain rooms with people in them, a way to delay or reduce needs for maintenance. Evolution there can continue. And water? You could, today, get rid of the softener and the brine tank and lugging those bags of salt and keeping up with sediment filters and killing microbes in the water and handling iron and calcium and lead and all that. There are products that can do all of that and more in less total space than a brine tank. And that's another place where evolution has a long and open road ahead. But for right now, just stay healthy. Take a new look at your smartphone and see if it has some tricks up its sleeve that you didn't know were there or just might want to be using more. Next time, well, our next segment begins the final calendar quarter of the year. And if there's a theme to the next 3 months, it's confusion. About politics and pathogens. About personal safety and public responsibility. About putting kids at risk or not on Halloween and more. Fortunately, the segment won't be about all the confusion. It will be about something we all have and never completely know what to do with. Messes. Don't you mess up. We expect you to be here.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on web services Thursday, October the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and remote attendance via Zoom video conference, and their website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will meet Thursday, October the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website for the New York Amateur Computer Club is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is limac.org. The Amateur Computer Club of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. and they meet via Amazon Chime. Their website is acgnj.org. The Brookdale Computers Users Group will meet Thursday, October the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. And the Princeton PC Users Group meets October the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.